Welcome back to Copper Country Today. I'm your host, Rick Allen. Later on this segment, we'll hear from Allison Mills and Sylvia Frazier from 47 North Belly Dance. But first, it's Pete Mackin of Evergreen Technology. First, let's just get to know you a little bit better. Tell me a little bit about your background.
Well, you know, I started in high school in news, radio news in Iron River, Crystal Falls, where I grew up at WIKB, then worked with Aaron Harper with the Upper Peninsula News Network, which was Dick Storm, Tom Failhues, and Aaron Harper, the old Cronkite era guys, as I call them. So I was the young cub reporter that they trained in and kind of taught the old style of news. And from there, I went to WLUC TV6. I was the Houghton Bureau reporter up here for quite a few years, and then moved back to Marquette and worked for the Mining Journal. And what happened in, 06 or so, I had a bunch of big stories. The retiree controversy, there was the biggest issue was a conflict I had with Senator Mike Prusy over the energy choice issue, the issue of allowing Cleveland Cliffs to opt out of its contract with We Energies and Presque Isle, which I was concerned would, you know, they were the biggest purchaser. So if you let them dump essentially their biggest provider, that would put the bill on the rest of us, which is what happened. But because of that, I left news, ran for office unsuccessfully a couple of times. And then in more recent years, Professor Jim Wong from the Material Sciences Department asked me to come up and run a new business in Hancock, which is a research and development lab called Evergreen Technology.
How does a person involved in news and then with some aspirations for politics end up running a a technology business in Hancock?
Well, covering the stories I covered, everything from mining, I did the first stories on Project Eagle. In fact, I did a few before that was announced that there were companies up here exploring. They're very convoluted stories. So I always tended to get the assignments that were Michigan Tech assignments, for instance, explaining ion thrusters and microwave steel processing is how I met Professor Wong. And so I would write stories for both for the local news and then for publications like Michigan Science or whatever. I would try to explain very convoluted stories. And so over the years, when I got into politics, I worked with Professor Wong on his microwave steel making technology. We actually got a grant to build a pilot mill up here. The idea was instead of using blast furnaces, you could use microwaves to process ore and turn it into steel right at the mine site. And so we worked on that, and it was that's still kind of out there. The tech's been done, but steel prices are so low, it hasn't gone anywhere. And when I was in Marquette, Professor Huang had been in China and met a company there that was working to pull heavy metals out of industrial wastewater. And he has a reputation over the years of working with advising as a tech professor in China on various technologies, was recognized by China for his efforts, and that brought him to the attention of this company. And so they were interested in getting his help to his vice for meeting new regulations to protect the clean up and protect the water there in China. And so they offered to invest in a new research here. And of course, Professor Wong's got to be focused on the science and has to travel between here and China and also teach. So he said, well, I know Pete, and Pete can figure out all the policy nuances of doing business with China. You know, we have all kinds of stuff with customs and technology transfer issues, public policy issues. You have to write a business plan, a corporate charter that both China and the U.S. like. So that's my wheelhouse. If it's crazy and complicated and government bureaucracy, I tend to be talented at untangling those things.
Well, Evergreen Technologies, that was a big splash when they opened up. I covered that. They're opening there in Hancock on Quincy Street. One of the few technology companies that you have in Hancock there, and so it's nice to see those type of companies opening up, those ones that do the research that have the potential of expanding and creating jobs and maybe luring other technology companies to the area because they could see successful companies there.
Well, it's very exciting. I mean, we're the issues right now. China every 5 years or so puts out a plan. And unlike, in the United States where each state and each locality has the, in China, they have one plan for the whole country and you'll do it. And so they've come out with, they agreed to different environmental standards globally. They're actually even challenging us in some areas as far as meeting certain standards. But, they were having major issues like we were back 50 years ago with polluted water affecting public health and their rivers, waters. So their standards are to the level now where regular companies, especially plating companies, mining companies, they cannot meet the standards, and they will not operate. Some have already been closed down. And so this company, Futianbao, already has, back in 2000, created an industrial park aimed at, they will handle, meet all the regulations. They'll treat your water. You don't have to worry about it. And you just work on your business. And they've been very successful. They already have two or three more of these types of parks that are pending. And so, but there are certain materials they need to pull that metal out of the industrial wastewater. And so Professor Huang, that's his expertise, is minerals and minerals processing. And so basically, you've got $1 trillion projected by both China and Goldman and a few other groups that's going to be spent on environmental in Asia over the next 5 years. And they're focused on soil remediation. They're focused on air, pulling pollution out of the air. And we're talking, you know, this isn't necessarily the climate change debate. We're talking actual real harmful chemicals, selenium, chromium, lead, mercury, there's no debate about, the metals we're pulling out of the wastewater and the pollution. So Michigan Tech has a unique opportunity in that you have both alumni and current professors and students working on technology that could help Asia and India and other developing areas pull this pollution out. And this is the pollution that evaporates, goes up into the jet stream and drops into Lake Superior. We can talk about that in a little bit, but there's some more recent reports showing that our levels of some certain pollutions, like PCBs and DDTs, are actually increasing in Lake Superior because of what's precipitating down from pollution overseas. So I guess we're helping our economy. There's huge opportunities for new R&D like us, other partnerships in this area that to happen here. But we're also helping our own environment by helping them. So.
Yeah, I guess one question that would pop into a person's mind is, of all the places in the world, why Hancock for China to be looking for this type of technology and development? But yet we live in an area where we have this microcosm of this same situation of former mining history here, the soil remediation and other attempts that we've had to try to clean up this area here, some successful and some not, and so. In an odd way, we become sort of the perfect place for this type of research and development to come out of.
You know, it's funny. I was in Chicago, downtown Chicago, kind of out of my element. Everybody was far more, wearing the Gucci and the Versace things downtown. But I was there with our investors and with some other visitors, some other industry people, and attorney happened to be out front that talked to me, attorney from Siemens, the global powerhouse in this area. And she kind of looked at me with my Walmart polo shirt and looked at my investors and said, what was your strategy to, because we have problems getting into China. How did this backwoods youper? And, what was your strategy? And I said, they came here and we brought them pontooning and drank beer and went four-wheeling and, shotguns and had a great time. And they love it up here. And then we showed them pictures from, 50, 60, 70 years ago when the area was denuded of trees and had, arsenic and cyanide, tanks leaking, on our shorelines. And the people that helped remediate that, the people helped clean up that pollution are still here. A lot of the people, Al Johnson's a hero of mine. He helped clean up the Iron River, which was dead essentially at one point of there was no life in it. And now it's, parts of it are Blue Ribbon Trout Stream. So there are people up here who are pioneers. I just met with Mel Visser. He's got a great book that just came out called Cold, Clear, and Deadly. And he was VP of Upjohn, which became Pfizer. And, he discovered through his book, it's, again, a great read, he discovered that, these DDTs, these PCBs, POPs, chlorinated pesticides, we banned them in, 70s, yet we're seeing, increased levels in Lake Superior that are bioaccumulating in our lake trout and whatnot. Well, that's because, there's a lot of complicated science to it, but, wherever you have the industrial pollution, whether it's in India or China, it's still going to go up in the atmosphere. And it tends to drop in the colder hemispheres, which in our case is Lake Superior, and it doesn't go anywhere. It like they say, Lake Superior never gives up or dead. Well, it doesn't give up its chemicals very easily either. So, he was a pioneer in soil remediation, pulling pollution out of soil. And we've met a few times now about, he's got some ideas of some ways we can address some pollution in China. And I'm sure there are other alumni with wonderful experience, 40, 50 years experience in industry in America that can help there as well. And it isn't just about China. I mean, we've got mining proposed here where I'm sure we could find tech that would, related to what we do, that could work. You know, we've got the Back 40 project down by Stevenson that's right on the Menominee River. Pulling zinc out of essentially, you know, mine water isn't that complicated. We could fairly easily do that. Eagle has a wonderful reverse osmosis water treatment system that's should be a model for any mine. So... You know, with our, we can leverage our workforce here, our reputation with Michigan Tech, the alumni, the facilities that are here. You know, we need some very complicated elemental analysis that we couldn't do without Michigan Tech being here. So it's there's opportunity, and I encourage anybody that's got an environmentally related tech that's at Michigan Tech to contact us, because through our investors, we have partners, we have major industry people that we're very lucky to have relationship with in China that most people don't have.
I know I'm going to get stuck on a few questions here, and I'm not going to get to half of the things we talked about, because this is, you know, I'm so interested in some of the things you have to say. You just brought up mining, and you know, you're kind of in a position where you see, you know, both the effects of our historical mining and what that did on the environment, and then we have newer projects and even possible future projects coming in with like Highland Copper and stuff exploring areas. Do you foresee that, you know, have mining companies learned how to do it correctly and safely to the extent that, you know, it can be done without having all that damage that was done in the past, you know, century?
Well, one of the things, you know, covering the Kennecott Project Eagle was a bit of a challenge because you had very, you know, adamant anti-mining elements and pro elements. And as a journalist and then later as a politician, I kind of got yelled at for both sides because, you know, it all depends on the science, you know, and I'm talking the empirical observable science. You know, when we analyzed the Eagle Mine, you know, it was, is the rock permeable or not? In other words, can things escape from it? Well, no, they can't. The geology is that case. There are other areas in the UP where you've got very permeable or very reactive materials that it might be not a great idea to mine. So it depends on where you're at and what kind of geology you're talking about. And the tech, you know, guys are some of the world's best for looking at that. And in Eagle, you had the Part 632 mining legislation that Senator Casperson led and our other UPR legislators worked on. That should be an example for the rest of the country, because we had hundreds of people, you know, 300-400 people sometimes at these hearings that were giving feedback. And we created, I think, one of the most effective mining legislation in the world, if not the United States. And so, you know, we could say, yeah, we're not going to mine here and send that to Brazil or send that to Asia or somewhere else. But the, again, as we just said before, the pollution is still going to get here. It still has the potential to get here, or at least it's going to wreck somebody else's area. And so, you know, if we have the resources and we have the ability through our technology and our regulations to mine it, you know, I say mine it, we're not going to see very likely another Empire or Tilden type operation up here. I mean, it's possible, but very unlikely, given what's happening, and you know that you can go to other areas of the world and do it better. But there is new tech, like I said, the microwave steel for mini mills and smaller operations. I think what we're talking about now, instead of the massive mining operations like the Minnesota Range, we're going to have smaller, more efficient, and more effective mining operations up here. And you know, again, I've pretty strong confidence, you know, in the both the engineers that are involved and in the companies to an extent too. I mean, when we determined that the biggest threat from Eagle Mine was posed to surface operations, the coaster brook trout and the rivers that were the yellow dog salmon trout, you know, the mining company spent millions of dollars to fix up the roads, and they are the nicest but most environmentally, you know, conscious roads that are in the UP. And you know, that's what we need more of. We need to look at that. So I think we can do it, but it depends on, you know, copper you're dealing sometimes with arsenic, or, you know, it depends what the mineral is. So you can't just say, yeah, we should have mining or not. It should be, well, it depends on, you know, what the science is.
That was Pete Mackin of Evergreen Technology. Now we switch gears and hear from Allison Mills and Sylvia Frazier from 47 North Valley Dance. Are you affiliated with like a larger group, or is each dance team independent of themselves?
Yeah, so we are actually associated with Sylvia's studio.
Yeah, so I own the Superior School of Dance in Hancock, and that is where we rehearse, and most of the classes take place for belly dance at this point in time.
Well, one of the things that we're definitely going to talk about on this show is, you know, people's idea of what belly dancing is and then why, you know, the women like to do it. I got the chance this first time see you perform at the roller derby, Kimono Roller Girls, when they were having a derby up at the Calumet Coliseum there. And I had, you know, I had heard that you were out there, but I had never seen you perform. I was blown away, and I couldn't, you know, believe the audience participation and how much everybody was in on it. And you had people come up you know, try it out, you know, from all ages too. You had, I think, some, you know, very, very young girls getting up there to do it. It was visually, it was quite amazing, and I just can't imagine what goes into being able to perform like that and do that dancing. Why do it though?
Because it's fun. I mean, definitely. I mean, that's why anybody has a hobby or does art, is because it's, you know, it feeds your soul. And I know for us as dancers, as artists, that's an art form that really resonates with the two of us and with the women that we dance with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got into belly dance late. I've been trained in all, as Allison has, ballet and modern and jazz and hip hop and like all these different styles. I got into belly dance later on as an adult. And I think the appeal for a lot of women is that it's not as... it's not a high impact thing. You don't have to be leaping and jumping and that kind of thing. But it does take a great deal of skill. So it's a brain workout as well as a body workout.
When people come and they go to your dance studio there and they're trying to find out for the first time about this, what misconceptions or ideas are they coming in that, you know, they learn that is not right?
Well, so I think maybe a good place to start with is belly dance is a very feminine dance, especially the way that it is performed in the U.S. And when people see feminine, natural feminine movement, they hypersexualize it. And so a lot of people, I've even had people be like, oh, you're a belly dancer. That's somewhere along the lines of stripping, right? Or burlesque. And it's like, no. You know, and that's the main misconception that we have to deal with, is that because we're belly dancing, it has a lot of other connotations.
You mentioned how it's done in the U.S. How is it different in the U.S. as opposed to other places where, you know, belly dancing is considered, you know, I guess I think of gypsies, you know, I mean, you know, Moroccan or type of, you know, in that part of the world when I think of belly dancing. And a trip to Epcot and Walt Disney World, they had Moroccan belly dancers that were there, and that was the first time I had ever seen belly dancing live. So, you know, that immediately my mind goes to that. But it was very much the same, you know, tasteful, very, you know, very beautifully done. I'm not going to lie and say it doesn't look good. It looked very beautiful, but it wasn't. It's done very tastefully and done very artfully.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and maybe a good place for us to start is to talk about why we call ourselves a fusion troupe first, and then we can kind of work our way backwards through kind of a belly dance history primer, because there's tens of thousands of years of history behind this art form. So we call ourselves a fusion troupe because, like Sylvia said, we're both trained as modern dancers, as ballet dancers, and we come to this with a lot of that Western dance vocabulary and knowledge. And we wanted to find a way to express our art through a belly dance form while combining it with a lot of other things. So we're not Lebanese. We're not Egyptian. We're not Middle Eastern by any stretch of the imagination. And belly dance does have its roots in a lot of Middle Eastern folk dances. So that's like when you were saying that it was cool to see so many people of different ages and genders and everybody coming up to dance, that's because belly dance is a social dance. You know, it's something that you would do at a friend's wedding in Egypt. There are a number of gypsy dance forms. Technically speaking, they're not even belly dance, but in the U.S., because so many of these cultures came together, a lot of them have fused, and we've combined them with other art forms. And so that's where the fusion aspect comes in.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I was just going to say, and we want to be very clear to people, like, that this is a fusion of styles and not this is a very traditional art form that we're presenting super accurately. Like if they went to Egypt to see some belly dancing, it would not necessarily look the same as what we do, because we do fuse it with other styles and take from different cultures to create kind of our own style as a troupe.
Now, the two of you, you have an extensive background in dancing. Is that required to be able to do this?
Absolutely not. No, we have people who have dance backgrounds that come into it as like a new style, because it is totally different from, you know, ballet or modern or anything like that. And we have some women that come that have never done any type of dance, and they pick it up just as well as anyone else. So no experience required, for sure.
Yeah, sometimes it's easier if you don't have a dance background, because it's a completely different kind of body awareness. Belly dance is all built off of isolation, so you have to learn to move your shoulders separately from your feet, which are keeping different rhythms from your hips and your chest, and you're supposed to have a smile on your face, you know? And it's, yeah, I think it appeals to a lot of different people, and the important thing to us is that even though we're presenting this as a fusion dance, and we're fusing it with our own dance background, we still really value the cultures that belly dance comes out of. So we still make a deliberate point to learn the Arabic rhythms. So we know, in fact, we have live drummers that we play with. So we'll play an Ayyub rhythm, and we'll do a Zar dance. We will try to do some traditional dances, and we haven't gone all Gawazi or anything on this. but we do learn the history of it. I think learning the history of belly dance and why it is performed the way it is in the States now and across the world, really, is pretty important part mm-hmm. of our process.
As when you're doing the dancing, you're not only just providing movements to the music, you're also providing audio as well, as because your outfits provide, you know, some ambiance with the different sounds that you create.
Mm-hmm. We also play an instrument while we dance.
We do.
They're called zills.
Yeah, we haven't done it at the roller derby yet because it's a bit echoey. But we play finger cymbals or zills sometimes, and depending on our costumes, they do jingle, so they can create some percussion sounds with it as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, it looks like a very physically demanding, you know, dance to be able to perform. What you know, how do you prepare to do it?
Lots of drills in practice.
Yeah.
All of our troop members are required to come to regular classes to keep up their skills and learn, you know, more complicated layering of different moves and things. And then outside of our regular classes that anyone can come to, we have rehearsals once or twice a week just for the troop members to be learning choreography and dances.
And a lot of at home practicing in front of the mirror.
Yes. Yeah, I'm pretty sure we all do a lot of that as well.
Yeah, if you ever encounter a woman going down the grocery aisle and it looks like she has this like really like concentrated face and her hips are like trying to do a specific rhythm, it's probably because we told them to do that in class.
Yeah.
Because of the demand for it physically, those who seem to be doing it for a long time seem to be in incredible shape. And I don't know what comes first, the chicken or the egg there. Becoming a good belly dancer put you in that kind of shape, or do you need to be in that good of shape in order to do it?
So belly dance is the really cool thing about it as a dance form is any body shape can do it. So we've known and had students and other professional colleagues that are every body shape. Like we've got from super tiny to very large women that can rock it out just as much as the tiny ones. So I think if you're doing it a lot, you are probably going to get into pretty good shape just because it is, you know, it's a really good workout. But you don't have to walk into it being in peak physical condition by any means.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and some of the muscles that you end up working, because of those tiny little isolations, you end up leaving behind what we call like the bully muscles. You know, so you're not using your quads as much, you're not using your glutes as much. Those are muscles that tend to take over like big movements because they're big muscles. That's what they're supposed to do. But when you're staying still and trying to get your body to move in smaller, more deliberate ways, you tend to work smaller, more deliberate muscles. And so you build up a lot of internal strength. So there's a lot of those deep core muscles, a lot of like the hip flexor muscles, some of your back muscles. It's really good for posture mm-hmm. as well.
you had started saying earlier that, you know, the two of you, you do this because it's fun, and a lot of people do it because it's fun. But did you get a lot of women that do it because it is a good workout?
Oh, certainly, yeah. I think that a lot of people might start coming to class because they think it will be a good workout and then stay because it's fun.
Yeah, and I know, even speaking from my own experience, so I have several old dance injuries. So I've got a low back injury that makes it hard for me to do the ballet and modern that I used to do. And belly dance really helped me heal from that and gives me enough movement so that nothing gets locked up and hurts. But I still get to strengthen all of those muscles.
Copper Country Today, we'll be right back.